Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, letting people know about the show. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be speaking to a researcher who's been hoovering up Dublin's air looking for pieces of DNA. And what he found will shock you. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of your comments at the end of the show. Before we kick off, if you are someone who uses ChatGPT but wants to actually really upskill themselves in terms of mastering AI for their day-to-day or for their business, you might be aware that I started a company last year called Get Started with AI. We have a new bootcamp coming up on the 27th of June. It's a half day where you bring your own work, documents, and build tools to help your day go more smoothly. You can find out more at getstartedai.com. All right, our first piece might unsettle you a little. Have you ever wondered what's floating about in Dublin's air? Well, it's more than you might think. Scientists have literally been vacuuming our air to unlock the secrets of our environmental DNA. Dr. David Duffy is Assistant Professor of Wildlife Disease Genomics at the University of Florida. He's behind this research. He joins me now. Hi, David. Before we get into the research, how are you doing research on Dublin based in Florida? How does that work?
Hi, Jonathan. Well, I'm in a lucky enough position that I get to spend winters in Florida and summers in Ireland. So
oh,
I
wow.
get the best of both, which means I can do field work when I'm over there.
Okay, very good. So listeners to this program will possibly be familiar with the idea of environmental DNA. But for those who aren't familiar, can you tell us what exactly environmental DNA is and what it can tell us about a particular place?
Sure. The easiest way to think about it is forensics for wildlife. So all species, including ourselves, are continually shedding trace amounts of our DNA into the environment, whether it's skin cells, hair cells, every time we exhale. And our technologies are sensitive enough now that you can take samples from the environment, whether it's water, air, or sediments. You can actually purify the DNA out of those samples and then work with it as you would any other kind of DNA sample from a piece of tissue or from blood. And because of that, that means we have a really powerful tool for assessing what species are actually present in the location, all without ever having to see them, interact with them, or stress them out.
Which is very cool, right? But given that we're all shedding DNA, all the people and all the animals, and DNA is tiny and so floats about, how do you get anything useful from environmental DNA that you can say, well, definitely this is happening here, or this animal was here at this time? How do you actually get anything useful?
So this is the surprising thing. We did think that the DNA, once it was out in the environment, it was quite degraded and damaged and wouldn't be particularly useful for most applications. But it turns out, actually, a lot of the DNA is protected by the cells that it's in, by the membranes that it has, which means it's pretty good quality. So there's a lot of things you can do with it. And the best way of thinking about it is, you're right, there's DNA from all hundreds or thousands of species in each sample. So it's like a soup of all this DNA floating around. But each species has its own genetic fingerprint. So by identifying the particular DNA sequence, you can identify which species that originated from. And what we've shown in this study is you can go further than that. And instead of not only cataloging what species are in the location, if you have good enough information, you can actually say what population they originated from. So for instance, we did this for lynx, we did this for venomous spiders, where we could say these species are present, but here's actually the population of origin for them as well. And in the Dublin air, we could actually do this for humans as well. We could look at the genetic ancestry of the population that was in the area.
Right. So before we get into to all of that, just a few bits on the DNA. So when you talk about fragments of DNA, are we talking about like something the size of a cell, or is it much smaller than that? Are you talking about pieces of chromosomes or entire chromosomes, or are you talking about a full, you know, set of 23 pairs of 23 chromosomes? I'm trying to remember all my genetics now, but are you talking about
23 for humans? Yeah, I guess complicated for other species.
So what are you talking about?
So it's a good question, and it's something we're still working out the fundamental nature of DNA. It used to be thought that all the DNA was just loose and free and floating about. It looks like most of what we're recovering, that's not the case. So we think mostly it's cells, mostly it's things like mitochondria and nuclei there have certain membranes that protect the DNA as well. You may even have small pieces of tissue, small clusters of cells as well.
Wow. And to collect these, you would what, use like fly paper, or like how do you vacuum them? Do you vacuum them onto fly paper, or what's the mechanism look like?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different approaches. So the most common one we use in this paper and that other people use is essentially that it's vacuuming air across a small filter that's actually designed to purify solutions. And it lets the air pass through, or lets the water pass through, but it will capture the DNA and any clumps of cells and any debris as well. And once you have that, it's very easy to go from that filter to pure DNA. But what we've also shown and what other groups have been working on is that this air filtration works really, really well, but there's actually a much lower tech approach, which is just a simple swab, that if you go and you swab a window pane or you swab a leaf, you get a lot of DNA, and it's not all microbes. You can actually identify large vertebrate species and almost as many species in the swab as you can in an air sample. So wow. It turns out the DNA it's everywhere.
Okay, so that sounds a little bit gross, to be honest with you, but I'm wondering how you filter through so much DNA, because if you're talking about a swab having several species, like how much of this stuff do you have to sort through?
Yeah, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of species per swab or per filter.
Wow.
So there's a lot of information in there, but we're lucky in the sense that we use what's known as DNA sequencing technologies, and these technologies have just got more and more powerful over recent decades, mostly driven from medicine and the biomedical field. We want to understand the human genome. We want to understand diseases and how to better treat them. So these technologies have been developed that could process huge amounts of DNA simultaneously. So that's exactly what we do. Once we have the DNA purified, we use these sequencing technologies, which will tell us about all of the DNA in our sample. And once we have that, we can use computers to identify what species are present and do other sorts of analysis on.
All right. So what have you found in Dublin's air? How long were you like sniffing the air? And what did you find about what's going on there?
Okay. So for Dublin, 1 week is kind of the set duration that we used for most of our samples. We also took comparative samples in Wicklow and in Meath as well. And in the city, unfortunately, and maybe not surprisingly, rat and mice DNA was pretty high in Dublin air. Obviously, we have more human DNA in the air there as well. We were a little bit surprised to find there was actually more pigs and cow DNA in Dublin than in rural settings in Ireland.
What?
Yeah, so that was a little bit surprising.
Is that McDonald's?
Well, exactly. So that's the way we figured. At first, we were surprised, and then we realized, well, every burger, every ham sandwich, every breakfast roll that people are consuming in Dublin, it still has the DNA present in it from those species.
Right. You can't differentiate whether or not something was a Whopper, for example, or a cow walked past the Malone statue.
Yeah. So this is one of our limitations.
So you found mice and rats, humans, cattle and pigs. What else?
Yeah. So there's about 1,000 species in all. So we find plant
DNA.
Yeah, yeah. We find flat DNA, we find fungal DNA, we find microbes and pathogens, a lot of human pathogens, obviously with a human population of that size. Some of the more unexpected findings, we could find cannabis DNA and magic mushroom DNA as well.
Yeah, not surprised by that at all. And so, like, with this swab or with this filter, do you just like, you mean, is it as simple as sticking it into a machine and a report spits out of all these different species? Or how do you, because it seems amazing that you would identify 1,000 species from this project. I would have thought that would take enormous computing power, but it obviously doesn't.
So it's not quite as straightforward as sticking the swab directly in, but we have gotten it down to within 24 to 48 hours, we can go from the completed sample all the way through to knowing what species are present. And it does take a lot of computing power, but we can actually do this in the cloud now as well. So there's probably about 3 hours of lab processing to get the DNA out of the filter. After that, you can run your sequencer, which might take about 12 to 24 hours. And actually now we can just upload the data to the cloud. All that analysis will happen. You can upload it from a cell, a mobile network as well. And then you can just come back in the morning and look at your results.
That's so cool. And so I presume you've done this in other cities. How does Dublin compare to other cities? And were there any big surprises in the data?
Yeah, so the main places that we compared to were places in Ireland and then places in Florida. But Dublin is actually the only city that we looked at because we're mainly interested in wildlife and in biodiversity. So a lot of the sampling we were doing in coastal forests here in Florida and beaches, and then in rural locations in Ireland as well. So we kind of used Dublin as a good control to show how sensitive this was and that we should be picking up a lot of different species in Dublin. But there are absolutely applications where you might want to survey different species, understand how many pathogens or what other species are actually thriving in those locations.
What was the most unusual species you came across? Presumably it's loads of dogs and that sort of dogs and cats and that sort of stuff.
So yeah, Dublin, I didn't say that. Dublin had the most dog DNA of any of the samples that we took as well. Some of the ones that I was most excited about was lynx, so bobcat, which we have here at my research institute in Florida. And they're very elusive animals. They're very hard to find. I've lived here for many years and only seen them myself once or twice. So the fact that we could routinely detect them using this technique was really powerful. We get alligator DNA from the air. We even get fish DNA and sea turtle DNA from the air as well. So we were surprised a little bit at just how much DNA is moving around between these different substrates as well. So it was really great that we can detect things that are normally difficult to study, like bobcats. We can detect birds and bats, all without ever having to stay up all night trying to find them.
Amazing. And in terms of the animals that you identified in Ireland, were there any that you thought that you would have expected to see but you didn't?
Good question.
I guess I'm talking about bats, foxes, any types of birds.
So we did find most of the things that we would expect to see. So it is a pretty powerful technique.
Is there any way an animal would not be detected, do you think? I mean, if an animal passed through here, are you saying that it's pretty, because that makes it a pretty powerful tool that you can identify this is something where you will, if you pass through here, we will know you've been there.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that still has to happen to know exactly how long an animal has to be in an area, how far the DNA is traveling from. So we're not saying that this is a completed tool that is absolutely ready for every application. There's a lot more studies that need to be done. And some species may shed DNA at higher rates than others. So for instance, we see a lot less cat DNA than dog. And it could be we have a lot more dogs owners at our sites. But if you think about cats, they're also quite clean animals. They're actually licking and making fur balls and maybe not shedding as much hair as dogs are. So there are differences between different species. It was taught for a long time that eDNA wasn't particularly good for reptiles, that they don't shed as much DNA. And we've shown that's not true. It actually turns out some of our methods weren't as good for reptiles. But when you use these newer methods, we can detect reptiles just as readily as other species.
That's amazing. I did a piece on environmental DNA for 10 Things to Know About, and we were talking about fish, and you can do this, for fish as well as birds. It's a really, really useful environmental tool. How do we use this in ecology, in understanding species, their habitat, and so on?
Yeah, so you're never going to replace field biologists and ecologists, and nor should you seek to, but what we can do with environmental DNA is we can really do things at scale, and we can get really broad assessments of biodiversity in all of the species. So normally to do that, you would need teams of experts, you'd need a lot of money, you'd need a lot of time. There's actually not enough experts to do all of the work that's necessary. So for a lot of projects, what you can now do is say you're investing a lot of money, you're trying to restore biodiversity, you can take samples beforehand, you can take samples during, and you can see if your efforts are actually paying off. You can compare different management efforts as well and see which is actually restoring the most biodiversity. And the fact that we can take these samples and analyze them in a matter of days and get an understanding of everything from a virus all the way up to a vertebrate is really, really powerful.
Mm. I'm going to end with a big brother question. Is it possible that this technique might be used to spy on particular individuals? I mean, if we can identify species, can we identify individuals' DNA? Is it possible that we could sniff the air and know if someone had passed through?
So there are a lot of ethical implications potentially around humans for this. And this is an issue that we have raised consistently. And we're calling for the public, but also for regulators to consider these things and decide where and when and how this information should be used. It is possible to filter out human DNA from this data so that people can't access it and they can only access the information from the other species. But you can start to think of surveillance uses, which is a little bit scary. Forensic scientists are very keen on these approaches, and they have used them in control settings to identify individuals whose genetic information they already had. They can identify them from taking room air samples or taking swab samples of dust that contains human DNA.
Wow. I mean, apart from that potential worry of it being used to surveil us, it is a very cool technique, and giving us an understanding of populations, how they move, the sort of species are in a particular area. It can only be good for ecology and understanding our wildlife as they need our protection. Dr. David Duffy from the University of Florida, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, are the oceans darkening? And why? Dr. Thomas Davies is from the University of Plymouth.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me. So the oceans getting darker has really important ramifications for animals that live in the ocean and use light for important parts of their life cycle. So let's think about the way that me and you use light, and your listeners might use light every single day. So we use it to get around, to navigate. We use it to see each other, potentially identify whether or not we find somebody attractive or not. We use it to find our food, to make our food. We use it to communicate in social groups. We use it to time when we go to bed, when we wake up, and our biological clock revolves around that. So we're using light in a whole range of different ways in our daily lives. And organisms that live in the sea and on land are using light for the same purposes. Now, the photic zone, which is the zone where natural light from the sun and the moon penetrates down deep enough to be used in all these biological processes. And that zone is home to 90% of all marine life. It's the most critical zone of the ocean for all the services that the oceans provide to us as people. And what we're seeing is that the depth to which that light can penetrate and still be biologically useful is reducing. So what does that mean? It means that one of the most important habitats on the Earth, the photic zone, is reducing in size. So this is a form of habitat loss. So the way to think about this is a bit like the loss of the rainforest or the loss of coral reefs. When you lose that habitat, you're losing that space for all those species to play out their lives. And that could have a really dramatic impact both on the communities of animals that live in the photic zone, but also on the services that the photic zone provides to us as people.
Never, ever crossed my mind to think about that, but absolutely fascinating. So the can you give me a sense of the depth as a percentage of what it was before and how that is changing? So if we imagine the visible area, I might be testing your maths now, the visible area of the ocean, how deep that goes, where you can still use light effectively, and then how that's changing over time, please.
So what we're seeing is about 21% of the ocean by surface area is darkening. We also see patterns of brightening in some parts of the ocean. So about 10% of the ocean is actually getting clearer. It's brightening. So on balance, what we're seeing is the oceans are getting darker when we think about it in those spatial terms. When we start to think about the actual reductions of the photic zones, things start to get really quite shocking there. So what we found in our data is that 9% of the ocean has seen a reduction in the depth of the photic zone by 50 meters or more over the last 20 years. Now, just to place that area into context, 9% of the surface ocean is roughly equivalent in size to the African continent. So that's a 50-meter depth loss of habitat across an area the size of the African continent, which is, when you think about it, in terms of the scale of habitat loss, monumentally huge.
But 50 meters isn't very deep, is it?
Well, I mean, it can be quite deep. So, we also report numbers of about 9% reduction in photic zone depth across large areas of the ocean. So it can be very, very significant. 50 meters. I mean, photic zones are generally considered to be about 200 meters in depth on average, although that definition could be challenged. So that could be about 25%.
Oh, so I thought we were talking about kilometers deep of this photic zone. So you're talking about a large percentage of this livable area, because presumably animals that have adapted to sea at a certain visibility level, they're just going to presumably either not survive or have to move into a shrunken zone to continue breeding and thriving. And so that's pretty significant. What is it that's causing this darkening?
So there's two types of darkening that we can break this down into. There's what we call coastal darkening. The coastal darkening has been known about for quite a long time, and it's caused mostly by things that are happening on land. So what we've seen over the course of the latter half of the 20th century and the early part of this century is we've seen massive changes in agricultural practices, land use practices. We've seen deforestation. We've seen increased precipitation in some areas as a result of climate change. We've seen urbanization. And all of these activities are contributing to basically lots of water falling onto land, which is then picking up lots of soil and lots of nutrients that are then washing into the rivers and then going down into the sea. And that soil is firstly scattering the light. So the particles themselves are scattering the light all over the place. But then the nutrients that are brought down with that soil from the land, often enriched by fertilizers from farming practices, are then stimulating the growth of microscopic plants, the phytoplankton, in the photic zone, and they're blooming and they're absorbing more of the light at the surface, and so less of the light is penetrating down through. So that's kind of what's happening in coastal zones. Out in the open ocean, the picture is much less certain, mostly because we haven't really thought about the potential for there to be darkening in the open ocean before. What we do see from our analysis is there are very large swathes of the open ocean that are undergoing darkening, and particularly around the southern continent, in the circumpolar current, up in the northern central part of the Atlantic Ocean as well. And then there are some other regional seas that are undergoing darkening. Now, why is that happening out in the open ocean? And I think the reason for that is probably that what we have with climate change is we have a lot of change in ocean dynamics. We have changes in surface ocean circulation and deep ocean circulation and the movement of water masses around in the ocean, which is like air masses on land with weather patterns. Basically, it's a change in ocean weather. And that change is basically changing where we find nutrient-rich cold water upwelling to the surface and stimulating, again, the growth of those microscopic plants, those plankton. And so in some areas, we're seeing lots of nutrient-rich deep water being brought to the surface, that's stimulating the plankton growth, and that is then reducing the penetration of the light down through the water column. So that's what we think is going on in the open ocean, but we can't be sure because we've not looked at it in detail. So it's a working hypothesis.
Right. And how do we measure this? Like, how do we know that the ocean is darkening at these rates?
So what we did was we used a long time series of satellite data, the longest running continuous time series of a sensor that's available, which is called the MODIS Aqua Sensor, which is up there in space. It was put up there by NASA as part of a NASA mission, and it measures ocean color data. And one of the parameters it measures is what we call the attenuation of light, a coefficient of the attenuation of light through the water. So by attenuation, what we basically mean is the rate at which light is scattered and absorbed. So the larger this number is, the more rapidly light is scattered and absorbed as it goes down through the water column. And the smaller it is, the less rapidly. So small value of the number, the light goes deeper. Large value of the number, the light goes shallower. And we looked at changes in this number over time in 9 kilometer pixels across the whole of the world's oceans. So we basically quantified the rate of change between 2003 and 2022. In every 9 kilometer pixel of the ocean. And we quantified whether or not that change was statistically significant and whether or not it was increasing or decreasing and the rate of that increase or decrease per year. And we also quantified if it wasn't statistically significantly increasing, we just called it a neutral. There was no change. We scored it as no change at all. So analyzing that long satellite time series, we were able to deduce this complex map of changes in this parameter over time. And then from that parameter, we can then calculate what the impact of that is on the depth of the photic zones.
I forgot to ask about the lightning. You said, and I understood why we might see this darkening, the darkening from stuff being washed into the water or from these ocean currents. But why would we see a lightening of certain areas? Is that the equal and opposite of the ocean currents that create darkening? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think probably that's true. What we see in some areas is where you have improved land management practices or decreased precipitation rates, you would expect to see a corresponding area of lightning, where light is actually managing to penetrate deeper into the ocean. And you can see that in some parts of coastal zones. You look in some areas and they're really darkening quite heavily. You look in other areas and they're potentially getting a bit lighter. Out in the open ocean, again, it's just the inverse of what's happening. Basically, it's those ocean weather patterns again. So things are just happening in different places at different times. And the net effect of things happening in different places in different times is that there's more nutrient-rich water at the surface. And so on balance, there's more darkening than there is lightning.
So, you know, it's easy for us to fall into the assumption straight away that any change is necessarily catastrophic, because we tend to use those words to describe things that are happening to our climate and our oceans and so on. But you're talking about nutrient-rich, material making its way throughout the oceans. We know that these nutrients can be very beneficial to wildlife. Is there a correlating damage or decrease of population or any net effect that we can see in the data when it comes to wildlife species migrations, populations, and that sort of thing? Or is that data not with us yet? Do we know that this shallowing out of that photic zone is necessarily causing major harm yet?
I think in terms of thinking about it, in terms of the shallowing out of the photic zone and habitat loss, that's quite a new way of thinking about things. And so the potential impact of that hasn't been explored in much detail. There are some kind of critical groups of organisms that one might go to as a first port of call to look at what the potential impacts of changes in the penetration of light into the oceans might cause. So one of those groups is the zooplankton, for example. So zooplankton, which live down at depth during the day and then migrate to the ocean surface at night to feed on those phytoplankton. Now, the zooplankton, they go down that deep because they want to be able to avoid their predators. And this is a key part of their life cycle. And of course, you know, they can't go as deep if they need to be able to detect the change in the light field as the day rises if the oceans are darker. And this is the largest daily migration of biomass on the planet. And it's a really important part of the transportation of carbon from the ocean surface down to the ocean depths as well.
And just finally, Thomas, is there anything we can do about the darkening of our oceans, assuming that it's having a negative effect on our wildlife populations?
I think out in the open ocean, it's difficult because it probably ties into the big unsolvable problem of climate change that, you know, even if you were to tackle that issue head on now, you would still be living with the consequences of pumping all of those greenhouse gases into the atmosphere for many, many decades to come. And that would still be causing changes in ocean dynamics and things like that. So closer to our coasts, actually, we've got a lot more control over the problem. So it's mostly about changing how we use our land. And it's really important to think about that in terms of how that benefits our sea immediately on our coasts.
Really interesting, and something I haven't really thought about. Dr. Thomas Davies is from the University of Plymouth. Thomas, thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
Now, to some of your comments from last week's podcast, we were speaking to Bob Breyer, who's an Egyptologist and the first person to ever make a real mummy using ancient Egyptian techniques. Fantastic speaker. If you didn't listen, go back and listen to that episode. It's brilliant. Katie in Sword says, I never realized how advanced Egyptian embalming was. Amazing. He's so fascinating to listen to. That's why we did a double episode, Katie. I was like, I want to keep listening to this man. And Rachel says, how long did the mummification process take for the likes of King Tut? That's not a question I know the answer to, Rachel. I mean, I imagine months, but I'll have a chat with Bob and I'll get an answer for you. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.